Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When I was a kid, my dad was a cop, and we spent 5 seasons of Loose Units, the podcast, talking through his cases, but the unexplained and the paranormal kept rearing their heads, because the story doesn't end when the killing is done. Welcome to Loose Units, the Shadow Files. Dad, this week I'm going to begin Loose Units, the Shadow Files, by reading from a 10-year-old piece from the Sydney Morning Herald. For sale, one good, solid 4-bedroom home with the infamous Snowtown Bank attached. The property is about to go on eBay, touted as a good family home in a quiet South Australian town, says Nigel Christie, sales director of Hale Real Estate in South Australia. There will be scant mention of its past, in line with eBay policy on murder memorabilia, he said. Mr. Christie says the listing will mention the property has links to illegal activity and that prospective buyers can contact him for more information. Mr. Christie says the current owners bought the property in 2006 despite initial reservations about its past, and the family has been living in the home and using the bank office space for music and games. It is just a quiet little town that would make an ideal place for a family or a rental opportunity, Mr. Christie said. Now, Dad, I did a little more digging and I found an article from 2015. In Vice magazine. And I'll read you from this. Every day, Chris Black and Rob van der Veen watch someone new turn up at the front of their house. It's a constant stream of the morbidly curious. Some come to stare and imagine, others picnic in front of the doors. Some leave cards for paranormal investigators. Some try to break in. Most come to take photos. Some try even to bring their own barrels. They want to get into the bank, Black says. They want to get into the vault. That's their mission. Go and look at the vault. If they can get in, they will. It's been 16 years since Australia's most infamous murder case, and people still keep coming to Snowtown. He and Black bought the bank in 2012. They're the ones who bought the house from the real estate listing I just read, Dad. So they moved over from Melbourne. They were looking for something quiet, they say, and the bank's history didn't matter. Asked how they feel about living in the building next door, they say to them, it's just a shop. You've got lots of people who've been murdered in houses all over the world, says van der Veen. You can't just let it rot. Even if they pulled it down, people would still visit the block. Mm. They go to Truro and they look at nothing, a paddock. Mm. They still go up there in flocks. Now the couple live in the house adjoining the bank and have slowly been restoring the property after years of neglect. The bank itself isn't used for much, they say, except for storage and as an occasional sleeping place for their cat. Now, first of all, Dad, I haven't been able to find out whether, since 2015 when this piece was published, they're still living in the house. But the fact is, Snowtown's population at this point was around about 400, and it's been dwindling because the town is grappling with a really, really sticky predicament. Mm-hmm. When your town is dying, right, when it's absolutely disappearing, it might be tempting to sort of reach back and rely on something called dark tourism, which is something that quite accidentally we have been kind of participating in a way. And that is, you know, people hopping from place to place, visiting the sites of horrendous crimes. So it brings in tourism money and it could potentially save the town. But then all people are talking about is the crime itself, right? If you go to London and you do a Jack the Ripper tour, that's fine because London has a lot of other stuff going on. But in Snowtown, there's nothing else to do. It's a blink and you'll miss it little rural. It's on the side of a rural highway. When you say Snowtown, the only thing that gets conjured up, even to locals now, is the fact that these murders happened here. And the barrels were found in 1999. Now, to people who are sitting here going, what are you talking about? What barrels? First of all, congratulations. You have officially dodged hearing about, I would say, one of Australia's, if not the world's, worst string of serial killings. It's fucking... And the fact that it was happening, you know, around it... Because we've done a lot of stuff on Loose Units, The Shadow Files, because Dad was a cop back in the 80s. And obviously, Dad, you know, we've talked about the Morehouse murders, the Claremont. We've talked about all kinds of stuff that was happening back when you were a serving police officer.
Really, this stuff
was happening back when you were in the fire brigade. Is that correct?
As it will be revealed in this at least two-parter.
Yeah.
It was very, very specific in terms of the... Of the people and the locations, and you, well, you know, you make mention at the beginning of the murders in Snowtown, but really, Paul, there was only one murder.
Yeah,
and when I weirdly heard and sort of came up with that, because I didn't know that.
But hang on, what do you mean? There's only one murder?
There was only one murder that was actually carried out in Snowtown. The other murders were carried out in Adelaide.
I thought you meant that there was only one murder and that people actually didn't realise that the rest were misadventure or something. But no, yes, you are correct. Only one murder took place in Snowtown. The rest took place way outside Snowtown.
Correct.
So the fact... So a lot of the townsfolk in Snowtown, Dad, you know, the few that are still there, because it's basically, you know, it's a dying
town. It's sad, but that's the case across Australia with dying towns.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just... this. For those of you listening overseas, Australia is a phenomenally big country. I mean,
huge,
really big.
Huge.
Tegan makes this running joke that, you know, you drive for 3 hours in Europe, you're going to pass through 12 countries, 900 castles, and through all these incredible vistas. You drive for 3 hours outside of Melbourne, and you end up in, you know, Mafra, or you end up in... You just... There's huge gulfs and expanses between places, and... Snowtown is just the most unassuming place, and the fact is the building that is the focal point of this story was rented by the killer for a very specific purpose, and that was the, you know, you'll find that out throughout the series, but it seems deeply unfair to me that this town should suffer.
I agree.
And how much of a role do you think the filmmakers have to play here? They could have called it something else, but
look, the town have tried to change the name to Rosetown.
Have that.
Yes. But as some, you know, I guess moderately clever journalist said, but it wouldn't help the town. They certainly wouldn't end up smelling like roses, he said, which is an unfortunate play on words. But, you know, I Googled the best attractions, the three top attractions.
In Snowtown?
Yeah.
Okay, and what did you come up with?
Well, it's quite interesting. In just for the listeners overseas, in Australia, listeners, dear listeners, we have things, and I don't know whether it's unique to just Australia, but we have things like the big something. So in Tamworth, it's the big guitar. In Coffs Harbour, it's the big banana. And it just goes on, like the big yabby.
We'd like to have you head in an arbitrary direction, and then the major export in that region will have a giant, freakishly big effigy with a gift shop underneath it. I mean, America has a similar thing, you know, sometimes. But yeah, we've got a giant merino sheep, a big banana,
correct,
whatever.
Correct. Yeah. But Paul,
so were you hoping for some sort of big snowball?
They do
or
have
something
big there.
Do they?
Yes. The number one attraction in Snowtown, folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is, and I think it's kind of clever. Paul, do you recall when we did the road trip with our series of live shows and we actually headed to Adelaide? Do you recall we stopped at the most mind-blowing, atmospheric, eerie, yet beautiful wind farms?
Yes, I do. Tegan drove us through these incredible wind farms. Yeah.
It was so wonderful. So cleverly, Snowtown have got one of these massive blades. They've set it up permanently, lying on its side, and it's called, get ready for this, the Big Blade.
Is that a smart idea using...
That's their number one attraction.
Yeah, but when I hear the Big Blade, I think of an edged weapon used to hurt people.
True.
Having said that, Dad, and I'm sure you came across this in your during your research, but apparently The wind farms near Snowtown are responsible for, I believe, 10% of the wind farm energy in South Australia.
Well, that's something to be very, very proud of. Now,
to the point,
Paul, if I was... Now, I don't want to take from any of the previous horrendous murder stories and all the vileness and the again, words fail me. But when I found out that... And I don't want to sort of... I'm not being sort of offhandish. I'm not being frivolous with my choice of words, but I was slightly relieved to know that, and I use this word judiciously, only one of the victims was actually tortured and murdered in the bank. So that sounds a little bit weird, but... It made me think that if I lived in Snowtown, I wouldn't feel quite so bad. Like, I know that all the bodies ended up there, and we'll get to how they ended up there and why they ended up there, which is really interesting. But it made me feel a bit lighter. Is that making sense?
I think if you were living there, you'd have to start doing some pretty interesting sort of internal reconfiguration to find a silver lining. And yes,
definitely.
The fact that only one of the people was actually killed. I mean, I would argue the way this person was killed was, absolutely terrifying.
But also with a
population that small, I mean, it's just you would walk past it every day. Dad, I'm looking at photos of the main street in Snowtown, and from certain angles, it just looks like every other Australian small town. Mm. I mean, it's got an IGA. You know, it's got a pub, it's got those kind of... It is a very classic-looking Australian small town. Even the building that that Rob van der Veen and Chris Black bought back in 2014 looks like one of those kind of... Just like a country store that's been shuttered. The actual bank buildings, the kind of shop front is closed up with tiles, so it doesn't look... It's just a... I don't know, and I'm looking through the town... And back in 2019, the former Scout Hall, and you've seen rural Australian Scout Halls, they're pretty big buildings. Mm. It sold for just under $35,000 Australian dollars.
Mm, nothing.
You could buy up the town.
Okay. You touched on the size of Australia. And now let's just cut to the chase, folks. And let's look at what we do. One of the things that people do when they go to London... is they go to the Tower of London. Mm. Now, the Tower of London, if you go back in time and have a look what really happened there, the number of beheadings, the appalling conditions that people were kept in the Tower, it was an infamous, it was a rotten, it was despicable, and some of the torturing that used to go back in medieval times was, you know, they literally wrote the book on torture, okay?
Yeah.
But people, and you go there and you can't see the end of the line for people that want to go into a place of terrible, terrible things that have happened. And yet, why is it that people can go into places like that and not even... It's interesting and it's historic, I get it. Why don't the people of Snowtown create, for example, maybe a murder museum? What do you think about that for an idea?
Yes, that is something they've actually been grappling with, right? In a piece published on ABC News back in 2019, it was actually updated, Life After Death, Dark Tourism and the Future of Snowtown. Mm. A lot of the locals are actually grappling with the idea of building some sort of memorial because one of the local advocates said, while the town has plenty of other attractions to promote, and I'm quoting from the piece here, such as its recently painted water tower and its giant wind turbine blade, like you said, local advocate Miss Altman agrees Snowtown should not try to deny its past. We've got to take any good thing we can get from it because guaranteed it's done more damage than good, she said. After the murders, it did not take long for some to see a silver lining. Souvenirs went on sale and attempts were made to cash in on the crimes. Documentaries and a feature film were made. Dark tourism is the practice of attracting visitors to a region where grisly or macabre events have occurred. In Snowtown, there has been constant talk of turning the old bank vault into a dark tourism site, potentially a museum. It's been suggested that something be done with it, said former police officer Joseph O'Connell, who was stationed at Snowtown in the late 2000s. The bank vault's current owners are understood to be interested in such a venture, but so far have not pursued it. While locals accept they can do nothing to stop the influx of passers-by who pull over to take selfies outside the old bank, many would likely be opposed to such a museum. There was a suggestion at the end of all the investigations and the court cases that the building would be taken over by the government and, as was done in Salisbury North, it would be demolished, so there was nothing to encourage spectator tourism, Mr. O'Connell said. It should have been completely removed from the landscape. Interestingly, Mr. O'Connell's brother Michael is the state's former commissioner for victims' rights and worked with family members of the Snowtown victims for several years. So, if you are a relative of a victim of the Snowtown murders and you drive past and there's a photo op where you can crawl into a barrel and get your photo taken out the front of the building, right?
Mm.
I would find that earth-shatteringly grief-triggering. Mm. I mean, that would just ruin me.
Okay, Paul, but okay, what about...
I'm not taking a strong...
But what about the families that go to Auschwitz and have a look at the ovens?
But then, yes, now here's the thing. That is a respectful tribute to ensure it never happens again, but the Snowtown killings are not a thing that were part of a large politically endorsed push. It was a lone madman, and I think what happens is there's a big push now, Dad, when you get a, you know, young male psychopath who's gone on a killing spree. If they've issued some sort of weird, hateful, racist manifesto on Facebook, the press is being kind of prompted now to not publish it and not put the words out, because what the killer wanted was to have their kind of madness broadcast, and you don't want to give them a platform. So I think beyond the sort of dark tourism route and beyond the moral, ethical, financial whatevers is the fact that these people were bad people who should not be celebrated. So are you condemning and paying tribute to the victims?
No, because...
Or are you potentially risking being... Because I'm looking at some... Dad, there's these... Like, there's little like fridge magnets and patches here that say, Snowtown SA, you'll have a barrel of fun. I've been to Snowtown and survived.
That's kids' stuff. I don't believe... Bearing in mind that the people we're going to talk about, the offenders, they're alive. As we speak. They're in custody. Yep. They're real
serving
people.
Consecutive life sentences, yeah.
And it's you know, the lead character in this story that we will discuss, he wasn't a local, but without sort of going down this particular path too early, I mean, again, and I'm not making excuses, of course, but it's important to have all the facts, and the facts are that when this horrendous person that we haven't named yet, when he was very young, he was 8, he was the victim of a horrendous sexual assault. Now, of course, that opens up I don't want to use the expression can of worms, but I will, as to things that can happen in people's formative years that can send them on this trajectory that can have ramifications that, in this case, are just unbelievable. And also to consider is that the people that are in custody now, to this very day, at least, well, two of them, one of them has expressed extreme remorse, but for two of them, it's just this, they still believe that what they did was, believe it or not, right.
Yeah, the motives are really strange. Yeah. Dad, can I read you something? I was going to send this to you, but I wanted to kind of read it to you live and see what you thought. Yeah. Because I think it's a really interesting place to start in terms of the actual killings. Mm. So this was published in The Age, May 22nd, 1999. And this, for many people, was their first point of contact with this story. Okay. I'm looking at a photo of police technical services officers removing items from former bank building in Snowtown. And it's the building I've been looking at photos of for the past week. Mm. And it's CSU people taking bags of personal effects and putting them in the back of a forensics van. First of all, it's very interesting looking inside the back of a, forensics van. Mm. But there's journalists around, and yeah, for many people, this was the moment when the world discovered what was happening in Snowtown. So I'm going to read word for word. Here we go. The remains of up to six people, one possibly a convicted pedophile, were removed by police yesterday from a disused bank vault in a small country town in South Australia's mid-north. See, at this point, Dad, they haven't even mentioned the town. They lead with the crime. I'll keep reading. Major crime detectives made the grisly discovery late on Thursday after inquiries in relation to three missing people led them to Snowtown, a hamlet 150 kilometres north of Adelaide. I believe it's actually 147 k's, but yeah. Three Adelaide men were yesterday charged with murder. The remains, male and female, were stored in six 44-gallon plastic barrels in a vault of the town's old state bank building. More than 50 police swooped on Snowtown, population 500, after a year-long investigation into unsolved missing persons files. Detective Superintendent Paul Schramm said police had been investigating the disappearances of Elizabeth Hayden, who went missing from Adelaide's northern suburbs late last year, Clinton Trezees, and a convicted pedophile, Barry Lane. And at this point, I'm looking at a photo, and we will post this on the Facebook page, of an emergency services kind of forensics tent at the rear of the house in Salisbury North. Detective Inspector Tank of the Major Crime Squad said police had been surprised to discover the remains. It is believed that when police opened the vault on Thursday, they were overcome by the stench of decay and immediately declared it a major crime scene. Families of the three missing people were notified by police, although the number of bodies and their identities will not be known until tests are completed next week. Now, I won't keep reading simply because that would kind of give away a lot of the storytelling we're about to do. But this is the moment for, you know, people living in Snowtown. This was the moment their lives changed forever. I'm looking at the streets of Snowtown at this point. There's a lot of kind of candid photography of the main street and of the side streets. It is a quiet town, but you can already see the journalists pouring in. 50 police in a town with a population of 500. That's not a single person there. Now, here's a question, Dad, before we kind of pivot towards the origin story of the actual killer slash killers. If you lived in that town where, you know, these small towns, everybody knows everybody else. I mean, do you think anybody there was kind of sus about the building being rented by this, you know, out-of-towner and
their
comings and goings?
No? I just think they'd be grateful, particularly the owner, to get some rent. And if you owned a building in a country town, and a bank's kind of an interesting building in that it, you know, it by its nature, you know that it's going to have probably a big strong room, like a walk-in safe, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because imagine
soundproof as well.
Soundproof, but also imagine having to actually, you know, put some sort of massive walk-in safe from scratch into a building would be incredibly expensive. So I guess that's a bit of a bonus. And people would be thinking, okay, it's a bank. My mind, if I lived in that town, would be it could possibly going to be maybe a shop that sells firearms, like a gun store. It could and gun shops are completely legal. They're very much necessary in regional Australia. Because farmers use guns, I mean, professional hunters for culling. It could have been an archery shop. It could have been a sports store. And a sports store, by its nature, is going to have a section that will sell firearms. There could be a local pistol club. It could be a private collector. Famously, one of our ex-prime ministers, Paul Keating, who has got one of the best clock collections in the world, he is known for, at least in one of his homes, has a walk-in safe, one whole room just for his clock collection. So you'd be thinking, the last thing you would be thinking would be that a mass murderer is going to use this building to store up an exceptionally large number of bodies. And I'm just putting my ex-forensic cap on now as I sit here. It's funny how I can sort of look over at glasses and taps and sort of look out the window and see another building and nice plants and just sort of looking, but I'm not actually seeing any of that. Because my mind is thinking about those police that had to actually unscrew the lids off these containers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Now, bearing in mind that there was acid used to accelerate decomposition, but I'm just kind of, you know, that's as we talk, Paul, I can't help but think of those officers that were required to actually get into the actual nitty gritty. But this is a story, in essence. His name is, because he's still alive, John Justin Bunting.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of that nursery rhyme. Cry baby Bunting, daddy's gone a-hunting. Oh God, isn't that horrendous?
Jesus.
You should have you heard that nursery rhyme before?
Yep.
Isn't that bizarre? But Mr. Bunting, he had been viciously sexually assaulted and bashed as an 8-year-old by his brother's best friend. And they were from Queensland. And he made his way. This is what a lot of people do. If you read the actual accounts of what type of a person he was in terms of that time, he was well spoken, incredibly polite, charismatic, would help people. He would cook. He would help people with their car. He just was an all round, on the surface, really nice guy. And because of that, he beguiled people.
He was manipulative.
Manipulative. Some have described him as a Svengali. And that's a big call. And he was very short. He was 5'4". I'm not sure what that is in centimetres. But that's kind of fairly short. I think you'd agree. Are we even allowed to say short? Is that a word you can use anymore? I don't know. The word short.
Dad, things are tall or short. I know.
But then you've got medium.
It's not a judgment call.
But then you've got medium.
Look, John Justin Bunting. Yep. Yeah, he was born in 1966. Yep. What year were you born in?
1960. A fine year.
Sure. So, he was born in Adelaide. And the thing you mentioned something before that kind of grabbed me, Dad. You said you said one of the three killers had kind of, you know, apologized and expressed deep remorse, but the other two claimed they were on some sort of crusade. Mm-hmm. Now, Bunting seemed to imply that he was... Yeah, he was very, very manipulative. And he sort of had the ability to kind of control people around him. But he was living in Murray Bridge, South Australia from 1991 in November. Mm. He lived on a street called Loman Street. And then he moved to Burdekin Avenue in 1997. and these locations were kind of pivotal throughout the crimes. But basically, what I'm trying to say is a lot of these crimes happened in and around where he lived. Mm. And like we established before, the bodies were stored in Snowtown, which is, you know, between 140, 150K outside of Adelaide, north of Adelaide. Mm.
But that didn't happen till the very end.
Yeah, so let's talk through, because he's come out and he's had his time in the press relatively recently and talked through some stuff. But let's talk through his history and what led him to do this stuff.
Well, as I said, Paul, he originally was from Queensland, and yep. he had undergone a trauma, which by anyone's account is, I mean, you know how things have. I mean, it's weird me saying this to you now, Paul, but is there anything in your past when you were very young that sort of, or was your sort of, were your early years sort of fairly, you know, devoid of any major trauma? But, you know, when you're very young, the problem is you trust older people. And then weirdly with young people, sometimes you get this feeling of, it's a transference of guilt, where the victim, as a young person, starts to feel that maybe they were complicit, they contributed, maybe it was their fault, maybe the person committing the act, either an act of sort of, you know, a sexual act or a sort of vicious attack. What one can often do as the victim is you begin to sort of twist things and think, well, maybe it was my fault. And this particular guy, Bunting, he became sort of obsessed with, bearing in mind, listeners, we're going to touch on some pretty sort of touchy subjects. So I'm, you know, again, a lot of this is, you know, whilst I do give my opinion about a lot of things, I'm going to use some terminology that's pretty upsetting, but this is it's basically from him. But he had a mission. He believed that all he had this thing about pedophiles, but it was the thin edge of the wedge for him, because
is this where his perceived vigilantism is kind of a thing?
Yes.
So he continues to claim that he was on some sort of crusade to rid the world of pedophiles,
to help society, and even from the doc when they were being, well, his story, which we'll come to later on in the doc, is just unbelievable as to what he did whilst the judge was sentencing him. It's just staggering. And the other sort of co-defendant, bearing in mind that the young guy whose name is James, James Spiridon Vlasarkas.
Who's this?
James Vlasarkas was a young guy that was sort of embroiled and sucked into the vortex, because it was actually four people that were involved. But he was a young guy, but we'll come into sort of how he got involved. He was the son of one. Oh, look, it's just such a... It's very... There are some very interesting parts to this story, Paul. Even though it is technically a mass killing, serial killing, most serial killers did not know their victims. That's one of the things that makes this so interesting, is that all the victims were known intimately by the killers, which is kind of so, you know, it's extra creepy, because what you're doing as a killer is you are enabling the chances of getting caught become incredibly high.
Yeah.
Because it's a community. But it's a very, very, I mean, in terms of the socioeconomic community, the victims, and some of the victims were mentally impaired, you know, some of them were just, it's quite depressing. And I'm sure that if you and I went to some of these areas that I don't think I'd like to name, you know, he definitely had a mission. And he like a lot of these people, he chose vulnerable people. You know, he didn't go and pick, you know, people that would see through his ruse, you know?
So when did the killing actually start?
Okay. Well, it started in August 1992.
Okay.
And it went for 7 years.
How the fuck did this stay... Sorry, I don't mean to, you know, have an outburst like that, but how did he... How did they... Dad, this is so complicated. First of all, multiple killers, coercion.
Four killers, yep.
At least four people, yep.
At least.
But typically, serial killers work alone, don't they?
No, these were people that, as one of the, as when they were sort of summing up, the judge said that these people, they actually loved killing. And Bunting, he, and I've heard this and we've discussed it occasionally, but he was the person that would look into the eyes of the victim, many of them who had been tortured in the most horrendous ways, ways that one of the things that they used to do that we will chat about another time is diabolical, involving a sprinkler. Is that what you call them? A sparkler.
Sparkler.
Did you read that bit about the sparkler?
No, I didn't.
It's so bad that
I'll be honest. I've avoided a lot of details about.
But
about the torture.
We will talk about it. But you know, the torture is very. And I think what happens with torture is that you get into a frenzy, and it reminds me of the tactical response group in Sydney, and probably it used to be called the TRG. It's now the sort of public riot and civil disobedience squad. But, you know, back when they were in the very, very early years when I was in the police force, and some people that you know, including your godfather, was one of the founding members of the TRG. And they used to go out to Long Bay Jail and other places and basically train. But what happens in these situations, Paul, is that during the training, the situation becomes so real that when they were practicing extricating prisoners from their cells that had sort of, you know, barricaded themselves in, the situation, which was basically a training exercise, it crossed the line and it became terrifyingly real. And they had to have police there to literally tear everyone apart because they became crazed and frenzied. That is what happened with these people. Some of the torture sessions that went on for days, and they were diabolical, and the people were enjoying it. They actually loved it. And Bunting famously used to look into their eyes, and he reckoned that he could tell the second they died. And that's fucked. And there's been no remorse, certainly from him.
Look, what we've done right now, Dad, is really set the table for something interesting and complex and horrible, because the fact is Bunting and his, I guess, crew were a really weird, complicated group of people. And in order to understand why they killed, who they killed, and in what order, we need to break down who these people are and just sort of set the table and explain, you know, how they knew each other. Because the fact is, like you said, the people they killed were people they knew. Mm. So if we can analyze this group of people and their close contacts, then as we detail the victims, because the first victim was killed August 1992, and the last victim that we know of was killed May 1999. That's 11 people killed between 1992 and 1999. All of them with some connection, I believe, to Bunting and his group of friends, I guess. I mean, this is starting to sound like a cult at this point.
Well, look, without giving too much away for next week's episode where we really go deep, when he was... Prior to killing a lot of the people,
yeah,
when he was torturing them and recording, he recorded a lot of the horror, which is a bit of a common thread, I hate to say, through some of the most terrible killers in the world.
Mm.
One of the things that he got them to do, Paul, and this is really creepy, he would get the victim to call Bunting, Wagner, and the other guy, Mark Hayden as well, you know, Vlasakis, he would get them to call them, sort of, he would get them to sort of label them with sort of almighty and the creator and all, you know, your holiness and God. And he had this thing about the victims had to call all these, the crew, sort of give them almost sort of godlike status during the torture.
Right.
That's, to me, look, there's so much to unpack, Paul, and there are some, all these things are sort of bubbling to the surface, these things that I want to tell you, but I won't, obviously, till next time. But
we wanted to do a kind of, I think a bird's eye view was really important for this first episode, just to sort of go, let's start with the Snowtown itself, with the actual place.
Yeah.
And then let's sort of try next week, we're going to zoom in and look at Bunting and his crew and their close contacts and look at the people who perpetrated these murders and then begin to work our way through the victims. And then I would say after that, we will be taking you listeners through the trial and finish by talking about, you know, what comes next for the town itself. Because the fact is, Dad, this season of Loose Units, we've been going through location by location and without meaning to, engaging in a little bit of this dark tourism curating. I mean, we've basically been building a true crime Atlas Obscura that would, if you wanted to, you could go to these locations and visit them. But is that morally okay? Is there a way to do it respectfully? Why do people want to do it? I mean, these are all very big questions. And we're going to dig in a little bit deeper next week on part two of our look at these Snowtown murders. And you know what? Now I'm feeling bad even calling them that. But what else do we do? Because that's what they're called.
Well,
and that's...
But they also were called the Bodies and the Barrel murders too.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah. Okay. You got a choice.
I got a choice. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening to part one of our look at these murders. We will see you later this week for a much-needed dose of levity with an episode of Loose Ends, but have a great week. Jeez, it's really the whiplash I get. My God. Dude. Thank you so much for listening. Seriously, everyone, we really appreciate it. Make sure, if you haven't already, go across to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Please, it's really easy. It takes like 10 seconds. Leave us a rating and a review. We really, really appreciate it. And also, speaking of true crime, and this is a huge deal, speaking of true crime, Dad, the first episode of Loose Units was a big deal, if you recall.
Mm.
And it was a big deal because Michelle Laurie, who co-hosts Australian True Crime, put our first episode on her feed.
Mm.
And all of the listeners to Michelle Laurie's incredible True Crime podcast hopped across.
Mm.
Now, Tegan and I do our weekly podcast, Dish Island, where every week we kidnap an incredible guest and bring them across to our island, and they can only bring one dish with them, which is their desert island dish. You yourself have been on Dish Island. You technically should still be there. We've had some amazing guests on this season. We've had Osha Gunsberg, Ella Hooper, Tanya Doka, all these amazing people. But, this week, this Wednesday, you'll be able to hear Michelle Laurie finally arrive on the island, and she's going to talk. She's going to dig in really, really deep about what dealing with true crime and what staring this stuff in the face has done to her over the past few years, and how it has affected her and how it's shaped her as a person. So if you love Australian true crime, it is an absolute must listen. So tune in first thing Wednesday morning, Dish Island. Make sure you subscribe to Dish Island as well. So we'll see you midweek for Dish Island, and then we'll see you later this week for Loose Ends. See you soon, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.